Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
The time has come for the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Russia, and China to recognize this reality. They must now break away from the remnants of the Iran deal.
President Trump speaking yesterday at the White House. Now, at first listen, the statement is very Mr. Trump, very America first, very unilateral. But then, in the very next sentence, the president said this.
And we must all work together toward making a deal with Iran that makes the world a safer and more peaceful place.
That's the president calling on U.S. allies to work together to make a new Iran deal, extending a hand to a new kind of multilateralism, maybe. Now, to be fair, the president has said similar things before about the Iran nuclear deal. But in this moment, as tensions with Iran spike into the red zone, the president opened up the door to a new global partnership around the Iran nuclear issue of Iran nuclear containment. Will U.S. allies accept the invitation? Well, today we'll ask them. This hour on Point, U.S. allies and President Trump's version of multilateralism around Iran. And you can join us. What did you make of the president's speech yesterday? Should the world start from scratch on the Iran nuclear deal? Or should U.S. allies stay the course, even if both the United States and Iran are acting unpredictably? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we're joined today from London by Ellie Garamaya. She is the Senior Policy Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. She advised European governments and companies on the nuclear negotiations with Iran from 2013 to 2015, and she continues to consult on safeguarding the implementation of the agreement. Ellie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you. Also with us from Washington is Richard Johnson. He's the Senior Director of Fuel Cycle and Verification at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonprofit organization working to prevent attacks and accidents from weapons of mass destruction. And he was a member of the U.S. delegation to the JCPOA Joint Commission and the six-party talks. And he previously served as the Deputy Lead Coordinator for the Iran Nuclear Implementation at the U.S. State Department. Richard Johnson, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Markus Keim, the Helmut Schmidt Fellow at the German Marshall Fund and Senior Fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. He has taught about foreign policy and security at numerous universities on both sides of the Atlantic. Markus, welcome to you.
Hello.
So, Ellie, if I just might start with you, I'll ask you all the same question. But first, when you heard the president's speech yesterday, did you hear it as an invitation to European allies to reconsider the Iran agreement? Was it a moment of diplomacy from President Trump?
Well, Meghna, I have to say, I myself didn't hear anything that surprising from the speech. We've had repeated statements from U.S. officials over the last few months and actually years now into the Trump administration, calling on European allies to basically dislodge their support for this nuclear agreement and join on board essentially the U.S. maximum pressure campaign on Iran, which is intended to corner Iran and force it into capitulation as things are viewed in European capitals. And my sense is that Europeans will be quite wary of this offer, particularly because not so long ago, within the Trump administration, Europeans were working for months and months to try and reach some sort of an accommodation with President Trump's team to find a new framework where they could work together to get Iran to come on board with a nuclear deal plus. And that was completely rebuffed by President Trump, even though the three heads of state in the UK, France, and Germany went to personally meet with the meet with Mr. Trump and convince him about this deal. And Mr. Trump turned his back on all of that negotiation. And that has left a very bitter experience, I think, for many diplomats here.
Okay. Well, Marcus Keim, what do you think about that?
I think from a German point of view, I had some phone calls this morning to Berlin. I hate to say it, but I think the German view is that the Iran nuclear deal is more or less dead, not legally, but politically. The German foreign policy deeply regrets that there's no common ground between the Trump administration and the three European governments anymore. I think we can expect that Germany and the other European countries are not expected to withdraw from the agreement legally. But I think in the next weeks or month, they're going to develop a different framework, and they have to develop a different framework and a different agenda. But because yesterday it has become clear another time and another time that the United States is not going to return one way or the other to the JCPOA or another form of agreement between Iran and the international community. And therefore, I think what's happening is that Europe and the United States are distancing themselves from each other on another occasion, not only on Russia, not only on China, but also on Iran policy. And I think what's the task for the European governments in the next couple of weeks or month is to develop some kind of European approach, not only to Iran, not only to the not only to the nuclear question, but to the region as such. And that approach will be expected to be without the United States and even against the United States.
Okay, so help me understand this a little bit. And Richard, I'm going to come to you in just a second. But Ellie essentially just said that she believes that America's European allies didn't really hear anything new yesterday from the president. And just to recap, Marcus, I just heard you said that the Germans essentially believe that the Iran deal is politically dead, and the Europeans may now be embarking upon developing a different framework without the United States involvement. So is it fair for me to say that it sounds like both of you did not hear any possibility, reading between the lines even, from the president's speech yesterday, that he is opening the door to some sort of diplomatic cooperation between the United States and allies and its allies on dealing with Iran's nuclear program?
Well, Magna, if I may on this, I think the difficulty has been that President Trump is exceptionally unpredictable, not just on Iran, but many different issues. But particularly on Iran, there is a sense that the strategy is really confused in Washington. One day, President Macron of France may feel that he's almost very close to getting President Trump to accept some sort of accommodation with Iran, some sort of easing of sanctions that will allow a political breakthrough. And then fast forward a couple of weeks, we've escalated to a point where the U.S. is taking out one of the most important military figures inside of the Iranian establishment. And so this kind of yo-yoing between positions is really creating dilemmas in Europe to try and understand what exactly President Trump wants. Because if he wanted a political track, the French and others in Europe really paved the way for that to happen a few months ago. But it didn't seem that the United States was willing to use its position of strength to show some flexibility on sanctions.
Okay, so Richard Johnson, let me turn to you because you were a member of the U.S. delegation to the JCPOA Joint Commission and those six-party talks. I mean, if I may, my understanding of the highest art form of diplomacy was finding that nanometer of daylight and trying to exploit it to create agreements or to bring parties together. Is that not even a, are you saying, do you share the pessimism I'm hearing that that's not a possibility now?
I think it's very challenging to get a sort of a deal now in the current situation. I agree with what was said by Ellie and Marcus that the Europeans are extremely frustrated. They see the JCPOA as an extraordinary diplomatic achievement, not only in containing Iran's nuclear program, but also as a European Union accomplishment. In the era of Brexit and these other criticisms of the EU structure, we have to remember that it was not just Britain, France, and Germany, but also the European Union itself as the coordinator that helped to run this process. And so they're very frustrated that this deal has basically been thrown out the window. And I agree with what Ellie said. I was actually a part, as a member of the U.S. State Department, of those negotiations to, quote, get a new framework. And we worked for months. I traveled back and forth to Vienna and to Paris and to Berlin and to London, trying to come up with a framework that our European allies could agree to that did not violate the terms of the JCPOA, of the Iran nuclear deal. And we got very, very close. And the story goes that just days before the president decided to leave the deal, President Macron was meeting with President Trump, and he mentioned that, you know, don't worry about this. We're working with Brian Hook, who is the U.S. special representative dealing with this issue on Iran. And apparently the response from the president was, who's Brian Hook? So that gives you a little bit of an insight into the comment that that Ellie made, which is that not only do we have the problem that the president says he wants a better deal but doesn't really know what that means, but you also have a lot of advisors in the U.S. government and outside of it kind of whispering in the ear of the Trump administration saying, don't do it, don't do it. So it's a little bit hard for people, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic to say that there's any sort of sincerity in the concept that there could be a new deal. Frankly speaking, I think what the Iranians did and what they announced was very smart. They took a very measured approach and said, we're still technically in this deal. We're still going to let the international inspectors monitor our nuclear program so you know exactly what we're doing, which is a key component of the deal. And they basically left it as a zombie deal such that if there was any diplomacy either in this or a future administration, you might be able to start to restructure it. But I don't see much chance in the near term that that's going
to
happen.
Okay. Well, we have to take a quick break here. When we come back, I'm going to press all three of you a little bit more about if there's any diplomatic path out of the pessimism that I'm hearing from today's panel. But we are talking about President Trump's speech from the White House yesterday and his call for European allies to completely step away from the Iran nuclear deal and craft some kind of new deal, and how that fell upon the ears of the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about European reaction to President Donald Trump's speech yesterday from the White House, calling once again for the United States allies to step away completely from the Iran nuclear deal. And we want to know what your questions are or what your thoughts are from the president's speech yesterday. I'm joined today by Markus Keim. He's the Helmut Schmidt Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He joins us from Washington. Richard Johnson is with us as well. He's Senior Director of Fuel Cycle and Verification at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonprofit organization that works to prevent attacks and accidents from weapons of mass destruction. And apropos of this conversation, Richard was also a member of the U.S. delegation to the JCPOA Joint Commission and the Six-Party Talks as well. And Ellie Garonmaya joins us from London. She's Senior Policy Fellow and Deputy of the Head of the Middle East and North Africa Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And she advised European governments on the nuclear negotiations with Iran from 2013 to 2015. Now, as all of you remember, the president yesterday began his speech by saying explicitly, quote, as long as I am president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And then later on, when he called for U.S. allies to step away from the Iran nuclear deal, he also added, we must also make a deal that allows Iran to thrive and prosper and take advantage of its enormous untapped potential. That's what the president said yesterday. Now, I wanted to play a moment for all of you from the French president's speech to the when he addressed the U.S. Congress in 2018. So this is Emmanuel Macron asking the United States to continue its participation in the Iran nuclear deal. And just listen to what he says and how he says it.
As for Iran, our objective is clear. Iran shall never possess any nuclear weapons. But this policy should never lead us to war in the Middle East. We must ensure stability and respect sovereignty of the nations, including that one of Iran, which represents a great civilization.
That's Emmanuel Macron, the French president, speaking before the United States Congress in 2018. Now, Richard Johnson, the reason why I wanted to play that is, of course, Macron goes out of his way to say the policy should never lead us to war in the Middle East. But he says virtually the same thing as the president said yesterday around that statement. Iran shall never have a nuclear weapon. Iran represents a great civilization. It should be allowed to thrive, etc. So is there no middle ground here, Richard?
Well, the words are good, but, you know, the policy of the United States over the last three administrations has been that that Iran should not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. So that was actually not really news to me. Mm-hmm. We all agree that Iran is a wonderful and great civilization. But this goes back to what I said earlier, which is that, you know, I think the president is sincere in saying that he wants to get a, quote, better deal. But it's never really been articulated what that is. The JCPOA really represented the sweet spot between all of the parties that were part of the negotiations. In early days, the United States, for example, tried to see if they could include missiles in this deal. And it was clear that that was not going to happen. And the decision was made that it was better to focus on the most imminent threat, that being an Iran with nuclear weapons. And if you could take that off of the table for 10, 15, 25 years, that sort of gave space to deal with all of the other malign activities that Iran is doing in the region. When the president left that deal, he basically brought us back to square one and reopened this issue of the nuclear question, which is a great irony because the entire time that I worked in the Trump administration, all I kept hearing was the Obama administration spent too much time worrying about the nuclear deal and not enough time worrying about other threats from Iran. But yet here we are again, back at square one, just as you said, we're saying all the same things. Mm-hmm. But, President Macron has not been able to get the United States to provide waivers for sanctions that would allow his diplomatic initiative to go forward.
I see. So, Marcus Keim, what do you think about that?
I think it's a bitter irony that on the one hand, the Trump administration says we want to make sure that Iran never gets nuclear weapons. But after 3 years of the Trump administration, Iran is closer than ever in accomplishing nuclear weapons. As Richard explained, they're shying away from formally withdrawing from the agreement, which is a clever move, but they are not complying with certain rules and regulations of the agreement. And this makes Europeans so frustrated, exactly the point you mentioned before, that basically the United States and the European governments share the same goal, to avoid any nuclear weapons in the hands of the Iranians. So the basic disagreement is how to accomplish this goal. And from a European point of view, the JCPOA was an appropriate tool for accomplishing this goal for the foreseeable future. I mean, it's easy to criticize the JCPOA. It might have some flaws. The sunset clause and a couple of other things, it might have some shortcomings, but we have no other options on the table. And so far as we know, the Iran sticked with the agreement. and complied with the regulation as supervised by the International Atomic Agency in Vienna. Therefore, I think that's the reason for the basic frustration. And again, I fully agree with Richard. On the one hand, the European governments are desperately looking for or desperately hearing to this announcement of interest in a deal, in a major deal between the United States or the international community in general and Iran. But on the other hand, they're desperately looking for the details, because as far as I can see, what is discussed in the European capitals, they see a strategic incoherence or basically a lack of a strategy in the United States regarding Iran.
Mm. Okay. So, Ellie, let me just ask you, if I understand correctly, part of your work, or one of the things at the heart of your work, is to work with European nations and European capitals to help assure maybe is not the right word, but to help prevent the possibility of an escalation, right, between mm-hmm. the United States and Iran. And yet here we are.
And look, that clip you played from Macron, he was very explicit that the policies of the West shouldn't lead to war. And I think for at least two decades now, since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Europeans have been very concerned that either because of the nuclear issue or regional contentious issues, the US or Iran are on a collision course towards a direct military conflict. And I would say we've not come so close as we have in the past week, at least in the last 10 years, of Washington and Tehran being at such a high point of military confrontation. And I do think the Europeans are now trying, you know, from in the narrow space that they have to play some sort of a mediatory role between the two sides. But sadly, I think that breakthrough, that political breakthrough that the Europeans were hoping for in September with President Macron's initiative, which, by the way, could have opened the door for much bigger dialogue with Iran beyond the nuclear issue, it's going to be extremely difficult to reach. And at best, what we can hope for is that we're going to have extended periods of cooling off between the US and Iran. But I think unless and until the US policy eases on the economic sanctions at play on Iran, which are, you know, the most crippling that we've seen in any US administration, we are going to see cycles of escalation. Maybe there'll be a few weeks in between, maybe a couple of months, but we're going to come back and see this movie again, I think. Mm.
But Ellie, I mean, to your point about the best that we could hope for is extended periods of cooling off, that, given where we are at this moment, that seems like a worthy goal in and of itself, does it not?
No, in fact, and I think this is where the focus should be, not just from Europe, but other countries in the region that are extremely concerned that they're going to be caught in the crossfire of any U.S.-Iran escalation. So instead of goading the United States into a more confrontational manner, I think it's in the interest of the Iran's neighbors as well to prevent a possible conflict right on their doorsteps. And I would say that, you know, one of the other ways where we could look at extending these cooling off periods to add a more optimistic tone to all of this, I do think that at least on one occasion, the Trump administration and Iran have been able to pull off a deal. And that was back in December when there was a mutual agreement on a detainee exchange, one for one, from both sides, which the Swiss helped facilitate. I think there is space for piecemeal measures like that, which Europeans and others could facilitate, together with this concerted effort of persuading the president that if he really wants a deal, if he wants his grand bargain with Iran, he has to begin to consider easing the economic strangulation of Iran, not necessarily directly, but by allowing others like the Europeans to provide some sort of a release of the economic pressure that Iran is under at the moment.
Mm. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me on today. I guess you had brought up that Donald Trump had said in his press conference yesterday that We needed to find a diplomatic and peaceful approach to stop, Iran's work towards a nuclear weapon, and that we needed to find a deal in which they could thrive. But again, and, you know, you and your guests have already brought this up, we already had that deal in place. The only thing that was wrong with it to Donald Trump was that Barack Obama's name was on it. So I guess my main question is, what exactly is the logical next step for the U.S. to get Iran back to the negotiating table when they've already said that they're not going to get a new deal?
Right. It's a great question, Michael. Thank you so much for that. So, Richard Johnson, you want to answer it?
Sure. And it certainly is the case that we see, for example, in the sort of NAFTA 2.0, where you have sort of minor changes to a deal, but it's rebranded and it's sort of the best deal ever. And this is something that actually those of us who were at the State Department at the time were trying to do, find a tweak, find a small improvement, and sort of say this is the next step. And I have to just say, before we go any further, Marcus said that Iran is closer to having a nuclear weapon than ever. Actually, they were much closer in 2013, before the JCPOA, because they had a lot more enriched uranium and a lot more centrifuges running. So the deal did accomplish this sort of cool down that Ellie was talking about. In my view, the only way to kind of get back to a deal is, first of all, to say there will be trade-offs. As Ellie said, we are going to have to be able to give some sort of sanctions relief to Iran and allow them to have economic activity, at least with Europe. And we're going to have to get in exchange at least the basic framework of what was in the original nuclear deal. Now, the beauty of what President Macron was trying to propose, and I think it's something that should still be pursued, is that he was saying, why don't we both give both sides a win? President Trump can say, I pressured Iran, and they are now saying, you know, we give up. You know, we have to come back to the table, and we are going to agree to have talks not just on the current nuclear deal, but on extending that deal and talking about other things related to the region. And the Iranians could say, you know, we stood up to the president, you know, we persisted, and basically we're going back to something that's very similar. That was the concept behind the Macron bargain, which was to give both sides a win. But again, the big problem here is that for Iran right now, having a meeting with Donald Trump is essentially death. It's a little bit different than President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un, which was very good for him politically in North Korea. So I'm not really sure, even if the president is prepared to make these sort of changes to his policy, whether the Iranian government will even show up at the table.
Okay. So Marcus Keim, what do you think about that?
I fully agree. I think one of the flaws of the U.S. foreign policy seen from the European angle is that the U.S. administration, the current U.S. administration, is not ready to give anything. I mean, just remember the 12 points Mike Pompeo outlined, I think it was last year, about regarding the question what Iran had to do to start negotiations with the United States. It was a couple of points, basically conditional surrender of the Iranians. That would be totally unacceptable. It's totally unacceptable. So on the one hand, the U.S. administration is talking about the art of the deal, but on the other hand, they are not capable to make a deal. So to accomplish a deal, you have to give something. And the Europeans are desperately looking for to a U.S. Investment, to put it this way, in this deal, as outlined by Emmanuel Macron. And yesterday it became clear to the Europeans another time, and very painfully, that they are not going to expect, that they cannot expect anything from the Trump administration for the foreseeable future in this regard. And that fuels my speculation or expectation that the Europeans will turn away from the U.S. regarding Iran one way or the other.
Mm. So, Ellie, we've got a couple of minutes before we have to take another break here. But if indeed what Marcus says turns out to be true, how effective can a new framework or a new deal with Iran be without U.S. participation?
Look, I think, Magna, no one is under an illusion that you can have a functional nuclear agreement with Iran absent the United States. I think at best what the Europeans are hoping for is to keep this deal on life support till November, where I think after the US elections there will be a critical decision point, particularly in Tehran, about where it wants to go, either with a new US administration or indeed a second Trump term. I'd add here that, my belief, Iran made a mistake in 2017 when it didn't directly engage in talks with the Trump administration. And in 2019, when President Macron put that offer on the table, President Trump made a huge mistake not to take that up. And, I think that the voices around the president, his advisors, are not the best match for a diplomatic settlement of the kind that the president seeks. And he needs to develop a new team around him if he really wants that agreement. I also think that the expectation of President Trump to somehow have a photo op with any Iranian political figure is now close to zero, frankly, after the killing of Qasem Soleimani. And so his expectations should be for an actual concrete multilateral agreement with Iran rather than a photo op of the North Korea style that doesn't actually get you to an agreement whatsoever.
Mm. Well, Ellie, the voices that you were referring to, I presume in your mind, include the Secretary of State of the United States of America. So, I mean, that's an influential voice in Mr. Pompeo, to say the least. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the European response to President Trump's speech yesterday on Iran. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about European response or reaction to President Trump's speech yesterday from the White House, calling for American allies to fully step away once and for all from the Iran nuclear agreement. And we want to know what you think about that. I'm joined today by Marcus Keim. He's the Helmut Schmidt Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He's with us from Washington. Also with us from Washington is Richard Johnson. He was a member of the U.S. delegation to the JCPOA Joint Commission and the Six Party Talks as well. And Ellie Garenmaya joins us from London. She is Senior Policy Fellow and Deputy of the Head of the Middle East and North Africa Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And she advised European governments on the nuclear negotiations with Iran from 2013 to 2015. So let's go to Abigail, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Abigail, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. I have a question regarding the Trump administration. So I know the Trump administration, and especially President Trump, has been using social media platforms such as Twitter to share his decisions and opinions about this stuff with Iran, sometimes before it's even publicized nationally. So I'm curious, have our allies, national allies, looked at those platforms and what he is saying, and has it influenced their opinions at all?
Abigail, thank you for your call. Marcus Keim, how important is the president's Twitter feed here?
I think a lot of people, a lot of decision makers in the European capitals are following the tweets of the U.S. president. But returning to one point I think Richard made, they're not really sure what to do with it because it's so unpredictable and sometimes contradicting He's tweeting one day this thing, one day the other thing. So to get an idea of what the U.S. strategy towards Iran is or any other given foreign policy issue, I think Twitter is not the appropriate instrument for the Europeans. And therefore, I think they are closely following and closely monitoring what is said and talked about and how Donald Trump uses social media. But at the end of the day, they are simply relying on traditional diplomatic relations, their diplomatic representations here in Washington, D.C., to get an idea what's the priority, what's the interest, what the current status quo of foreign policy in the United States.
Mm. Let's go to John, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. John, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I am a real big supporter of President Trump, and everyone is kind of saying he doesn't have a plan. I beg to differ. There's a solid plan in place. When he killed Soleimani, he knew exactly what he was going to get. He was going to get the threats. He was going to get everything. And the way that the outrage was that we have millions of people in the street. And I want to ask about that at the end of this call, if I may. We have millions of people on the street. They're saying, death to America, death to America. And they bomb a bunch of dirt. And then they tell their people that they've killed a bunch of Americans. Now, that's just Iranians being Iranians. Now, you know, everyone knows they want Iraq. And they do everything through proxies. I don't care what they do with Iran. And I want to ask your guest a very simple question. Does he think that every single person that was in the streets in Iran mourning the death of Soleimani was there out of free will? Or do you think there might have been a few that compelled the authorities, went to houses and say, you are going to the mourning of Soleimani, right? Mm. Now, that is what I've heard from intelligence people. So I want to ask your guest if he truly thinks that could have happened. Because it's outrage, right. And the response that was sickening.
Well, John, thank you for your call. And I'm actually going to also ask folks to respond to your other assertion that you believe that the president has his plan is clear to contain Iran. So thank you for that. But Ellie, would you like to respond to John's first question? He is casting doubt on the veracity of feeling in the streets of Tehran at the funeral of Soleimani.
Sure. Let me just start by saying, you know, if the plan is indeed to contain or deter Iran, well, I'm not sure that with this policy, the U.S. is either rolling back Iranian influence or deterring an uptick in Iranian so-called bad behavior. Because right now, I think the biggest cost that the U.S. may have paid through this escalation round is losing over a decade of hard work and resources that were put into Iraq, and essentially undermining the gains that were made, undermining the stability, potentially risking creating an opening for ISIS, which the president has been very keen to counter. So with every action, there comes a cost and a benefit. And I think that the White House will have to do a lot of thinking about whether with this one move to take out an important but not the only person within Iran's IRGC, they may have actually undermined U.S. presence in Iraq for a very long time to come. Mm. And then on the question about the mourners that came out onto the streets of Iran, look, I don't think that we can rule out at all that there was coercion for part of those that turned out on the streets. But I would find it highly unlikely that even as repressive as the state security apparatus inside Iran can be, that there could have been hundreds of thousands brought out across cities in Iran. And I think an important part for your American listeners to understand is that Qasem Soleimani was viewed very differently outside of Iran than he was inside of Iran. And there was a very sophisticated media campaign around him in recent years, particularly in the fight against ISIS, that he was leading, amongst other things. And so inside Iran, even people who disagree with the political establishment saw him as a type of national hero. Of course, this isn't representative of everyone in Iran, but I do think the degree of people who came out across the country for his funeral surprised many people who've been watching Iran for a long time.
Okay. Richard Johnson, I wanted to switch gears a tiny bit here because I want to capitalize on your experience in having been inside the room, because we are, you know, we're talking, of course, we're focusing a lot on European allies here. But I just want to quite simply ask you, given your experience in those six-party talks, how do you think Russia and China look upon this moment right now?
The Russians and the Chinese are, on one hand, extremely nervous, and on the other hand, kind of laughing into their hands. Because I think this only bolsters the ability for Russia and China to have more influence in the region as the United States steps away. Of course, they're also concerned about the instability that the incoherence of the Trump administration's policies have caused and the potential for sort of blundering into a war. Russia, despite all of our really negative interactions with Russia over the past few years, starting even with the Ukraine intervention, the one bright spot with our U.S.-Russia relationship was on Iran, because Russia was very committed and still is to not allowing Iran to have a nuclear weapon. There would have been no JCPOA without Russia. The enriched uranium that was removed from Iran went to Russia. The Russians helped to take apart and convert certain facilities in Iran. The Chinese were also helping to convert and still are, apparently, a reactor that could have produced plutonium for a nuclear bomb, which, by the way, the Iranians did not say that they were abandoning that project. Another sign that the Iranians are trying to keep this deal alive. So, multilateral pressure was the only way to get a deal. It was not a perfect deal, and there could have been more done, perhaps. But to go back to the original question, is there a multilateral approach here? The answer is yes, and it was the approach that we took with the JCPOA. I'm not sure how you are going to get back to that unless, again, there is a shift in policy. And just one last thing I would say is on the question about is there a plan there, I will say I worked for the State Department for 18 months under the Trump administration, and I've worked for Republican and Democratic administrations. I've never seen the level of policy coordination, inconsistency, and chaos than I saw working for 18 months at the State Department. So I am actually very dubious on the idea that there was a coherent plan going forward, because there was not when I was working there.
Okay. Marcus Keim, then, I mean, I keep thinking about what you said earlier in the program, that the Germans are considering the possibility of having to develop a different framework, move forward without the United States. Does that mean that they are more likely then to turn ever more towards, I'm thinking China in particular, but of course Russia as well?
I think, to be clear, the German government will not officially withdraw from the agreement. I think Richard made the point, or Ellie, I forgot. They will simply consider this agreement dysfunctional and to be dormant, but they will insist to keep it for better times, as we have done from a German point of view with other institutions and arrangements. One another example would be the NATO-Russia Council, which is totally dysfunctional, but the German point of view is keep it for better times. If we have accomplished to negotiate certain agreements, certain institutions, keep it for better times. However, I think it will embolden those in European capitals who say the classical transatlantic security relationship is dead, as we know it, as we have seen for the last 70 years. And there are two necessary conclusions. First, a more autonomous action by the European Union, called strategic autonomy of the European Union. And the second conclusion would be we have to look for other partners in the international arena. And with regards to Iran, that could be or will be China and Russia. With regards to other issues like climate change, that might be India or Brazil or whatever. And with regards to international trade, there might be another partner as well. So one conclusion European governments will come to will be some kind of, how to put it, let's call it diversification of traditional security relations in the international system.
Interesting. Well, we have about 5 minutes left here, and I just want to once again lean on Ellie and Richard's experience in having been participants in previous negotiations with Iran. I mean, Ellie, if you can we? Is there a moment or a story in your experience when you were part of those negotiations from 2013 to 2015 that might help us understand how ideally we might best move forward now?
Well, look, I was looking at this through the lens of a third party think tanker who was in contact with both Europeans and Iranians throughout the negotiations, looking at how political messaging should be addressed to both sides to avoid misunderstandings. I think it took a really long time and a lot of hard work to get everybody around the table to the nuclear deal. I think that the glimmer of hope we can have is that nobody thought we could have gotten to the nuclear deal before that opening really came through between the Obama administration and the Iranian political leadership. And I do think no matter how bad things look today, there is still a possibility, most likely, in my opinion, under a new administration, but perhaps maybe even under the Trump administration, if, as I said, mentioned before, he surrounds himself with the right team of advisors that can get him to a negotiated settlement with Iran that he says he wants. Because my sense is that, whether it was John Bolton or now Secretary Pompeo, there is a different agenda in mind for these senior advisors, and there are very few people left in the room that are able to guide the president towards a political track.
Mm. Richard Johnson, same question to you. I mean, pull back the curtain for us. What's going on behind the scenes or has gone on behind the scenes in the past that might help us envision a path forward?
Well, I guess the only anecdote that I would provide is that, when you get down to real technical issues, a lot of the political divides start to go away. And I was very fortunate to participate in a lot of the work on these very technical issues. How do you convert a reactor so it doesn't produce as much plutonium? How do you define what a centrifuge is and what it looks like? And when you got U.S., European, Russian, and Iranian technical people and scientists in a room, the politics went away. The Iranians are extremely good at what they do, as are our other partners on the technical side. I think that there is an interest in trying to cooperate together. And it was not easy. There were always challenges. And I should say that I was not part of the original negotiating team that got the deal. I was part of the implementation team. Mm-hmm. But that was a negotiation in itself. And that's another thing that we need to remember with Iran is the negotiation itself never ends. But the important part is to get to the negotiating table. And when we did that, we were able to make progress throughout the entire period that the JCPOA was sort of fully in effect. Yes, we had disputes and some of them never came to light in the public because we found a way to use these mechanisms to solve these problems. Diplomacy can work, but there has to be a demonstration from all sides that you're in it in good faith.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask you. So, I mean, can the technocrats even get to the table given what the diplomats and heads of state are saying right now?
Yeah. So, the one thing that I've been saying that I think is the bare minimum approach, and I think that the Trump administration could do this. And again, I actually do believe the president wants to get a better deal. And if I had him in the room for 30 seconds, I guess what I would say is reopen a channel to Iran. Find a way to have some communication with them. One of the things we lost with the JCPOA in terms of the U.S. departure was the regular interactions between the Secretary of State and Foreign Minister Zarif and with other U.S. senior leaders and Iranian leaders. Right now, we have no way to even sort of have a discussion about de-escalation because we don't even know which phone number to call and which email address to type into our phones. So if you want to get down the path towards a better deal, we have to reopen a diplomatic channel that could be through the New York mission, that could be help through the Swiss or the Omanis, but preferably directly with Iran.
Richard, just for clarity, just very, very briefly, do you mean it literally that we don't know what phone number to call or what email to put in, or is that just a turn of phrase here?
I would think that we maybe don't know, but I certainly know that we did know during the Obama administration. So maybe they've changed their number. I don't know.
Well, Richard Johnson, he was a member of the U.S. delegation to the JCPOA Joint Commission and the Six-Party Talks. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thank you.
And Eli Garonmaya, Senior Policy Fellow and Deputy of the Head of Middle East and North Africa Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Eli, thank you.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And Markus Keim, the Helmut Schmidt Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. It was a pleasure to have you on the program as well. Thank you so much, Markus.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.